Hello, and welcome to Studio Sessions, the big red and shiny podcast where we talk with artists about the ideas, inspiration, and processes that go into their work. I'm your host, Matt Kuhlman, and my guest this episode is Carlos Jimenez Caua. Carlos is a 2012 MFA graduate from the Massachusetts College of Art and Design, and he earned his undergraduate degree from Princeton in 2008. Carlos's recent body of work uses photographic processes to produce many variations of flat planes of pure color. Some of his compositions introduce folds and cuts into the paper, while other pieces simply feature continuous color gradients. These minimalist works are drastically different from his previous work, which featured more traditional photography subjects like observable scenes and landscapes. Join me as he discusses the ideas he is exploring in his newer series. Thanks for joining us today to talk about your work.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And so I'm familiar with some of your work, and I don't really know much else about you, so do you want to explain a little bit about your career up to this point?
Sure. Well, I just got my MFA at MassArt, Massachusetts College of Art and Design in Boston. And before that, I was in New York just working for a couple of years after my undergraduate studies, which were at Princeton, which I finished in 2008. And while there, I studied both chemistry and visual arts. Chemistry was my major, but visual arts was my, what they call certificate, but what's actually a minor.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. How did you decide to move from a chemistry focus into the arts? It seems like
right.
Chemistry might be a little bit more of a solid career choice or something.
Right. That's not fair to say. I suppose I studied both for the same reasons. That is to say, I didn't study chemistry for any sort of vocational aspirations. Of course, like it would give you a better job than say studying art.
Mm-hmm.
But I just thought when I was 18 and 19 years old, chemistry up to that point was the thing that I found that I sort of felt most amazed me, and I wanted to be part of this thing called chemistry because of its elegance, because of the beauty I found in the topic and the study of chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
and then I discovered something I liked even more, or maybe at the same level, which was art. And it wasn't so much a replacement of one with the other, it was more that I liked both, so I studied both in college.
Mm. Yeah, you did move into photography eventually, which is a very chemistry-heavy medium.
Right, and it's interesting because, I mean, in those days, people always wanted to talk about the confluence of both, how I did both in my practice, but it's not something that really surfaced up until maybe these days. It could be argued a little more. Mostly conceptually or like structurally how my work works, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, I have gone back to sort of like the chemical processes of the darkroom lately.
Mm-hmm. So with your work, are we seeing mostly manual processes? Do you shy away from the digital products that are coming out? Because I know there's a lot of conflict with particular in photography among like traditional processes and digital processes.
Right.
How do you deal with that in your work, or is it a factor at all even?
Well, if you were to look at my work, maybe just statistically, I spend most of my time in the darkroom.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not to say that I'm say like a darkroom snob or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I and even included in my thesis show were digital, that is to say pieces that were made, photographs that were made digitally and outputted digitally, that is a photograph with a DSLR and outputted as inkjet prints. Which is not something that I'm against in any way. If anything, I see it as all sort of as an equal playing field. Either lush 4 or 5 negatives on made with nice paper and printers, or images made on an iPhone or even like crappier
mm-hmm.
cameras. And I even have one particular piece that's made from not only a cell phone image but a cell phone image that was sent and degraded when I received it.
Mm-hmm.
So I have no, I'm more interested in sort of image making as such rather than say like a particular style of image making, either darkroom or say like even a style in terms of content like portraiture or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And from the work that I saw on your website, was there a period where you were dealing more with the transition from a chemistry thought process to what we're seeing now, because looking at your work now, I don't really see the kind of scientific thought process that would be involved in chemistry in the work. Like, it's very nice, but
right.
I don't see that kind of background coming from it.
Right. Well, it's interesting you say that, because one of my teachers recently was telling me sort of the exact opposite, that that it has moved more into like a systematic way of thinking, whereas before, like with work I made in Lima or in construction sites, that was more sort of based on sort of I say it's only descriptive, it's sort of like a traditional looking and appreciating of photographs, that is to say, like a nice scene captured in two dimensions and made a nice print of that. But these days, sort of putting imagery aside and more focusing like the systematics of the darkroom or of image making, and try to sort of piece apart the parts that seemed whole in the beginning, which is sort of like I don't want to labor that too much, but it's somewhat of a scientific endeavor, right? But you could also say it's a philosophical endeavor. Maybe that's a better way to put it.
Mm-hmm. And since we're getting on the subject, let's jump right into your most recent work, which I saw. From what I understand, you were taking a whole piece of paper in some instances and folding it into different shapes, and then exposing and then unfolding it, and the different parts would be separated, and there were other kind of process series where an image would either come into or out of focus over a series of exposures. Do you want to explain a little bit more what you were doing with these works?
Sure, yeah. Well, with the folding work in particular, I guess I started to think about the print as such, so the print as divorced from imagery and photography, so, you know, the piece of paper upon which the image comes or is printed upon. And I guess I started to think about sort of the language of this piece of paper. And of course I'm speaking somewhat of a figurative way, but somewhat not as well. So what operations can you do to a piece of paper that are sort of inherent to this piece of paper? And already you can tell this is somewhat of like a modernistic exercise.
Mm-hmm.
So a piece of paper sort of inherently has this operation, which is folding, which, say for instance, a phone or a telephone pole or a desk, these things don't lend themselves to folding.
Mm-hmm.
So it invites sort of this operation of folding onto itself. And further within that, so say there's this operation, and maybe we can even call it like language of folding that can only exist with paper.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I saw as there existing sort of certain modes or certain sort of like grammatical statements that could be made with this language. So there were certain folds that came sort of from the paper rather than sort of me taking this aggressive stance and folding the paper.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that there was folding that the paper sort of almost in an anthropomorphic way wanted to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So with the folding pieces, I would, you know, fold edges to edges or corners to corners, and then expose them in such a way that I sort of used all the operations that then existed in the color head enlarger in a dark room.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a cyan filter, yellow filter, and a magenta filter, and I would expose them in, for the most part, and actually almost exclusively with only one of these filters, and see what happens when there's a fold that comes from the paper, and then this paper being photographic, you then use another sort of base operation from the enlarger, and seeing what happens when those two things mix.
Mm-hmm. It's a very well thought out process there. Are you ever concerned that the end result might not be able to convey that to the viewer in some way, because it's incredibly abstract imagery? And
right. Yeah, no, totally. And what I tell you isn't, it's sort of, that's me sort of thinking through the work.
Mm-hmm.
And, but let me say that, I don't take it as a matter of, I don't take for granted that I'm a visual artist. And so I know I sometimes come up with like sort of systematic ways of making work. But at the end of the day, you know, if I make this and I sort of have a sketch that I think is exciting and I go into the studio and do it, and it turns out kind of to be like a boring piece of work, then it's immediately tossed aside. So always the visual output is sort of the most important factor.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff, the variables and the equations that go into making that are fun in and of themselves, but I never want that to be the piece. So it's always always about what's produced.
Mm-hmm. And do you want to go on and explain some of the other pieces that are in your recent work?
Sure.
There's a some portraiture work there, it looked like.
Right.
And other geometric color patterns.
Right. So, I guess maybe I'll talk about some of the pieces where I was cutting paper. And that came from thinking about this operation of folding, which I spent some months sort of thinking about, almost exclusively doing. And thinking about this operation in sort of like a kindergarten way. So what's the next step after folding? After folding is cutting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So first you fold paper and then you cut paper. And I felt that cutting was also this this operation that was inherent to paper. So you can't cut eyeglasses. You can't cut, usually a building.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can think of that, but it's stretching sort of the...
Not with scissors, at least.
Right. It's stretching sort of the grammar of what cut.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So then I was interested in what happened when you combined this cutting with then like the operations of an enlarger, and I still cut the paper in such a way that I think again thinking of transferring some of my own agency to the paper, so cutting the paper in such a way that the paper would want to be cut, and still using the very classic sizes of photography, sort of 4x5, 8x10, 11x14 paper, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So with these recent cut pieces, the cuts were made in such a way to sort of eke out the 11x11-inch square that exists within an 11x14-inch piece of paper. So that means that the cut is 3 inches from the longest, well, I guess the shorter edge, but
mm-hmm.
3 inches from that, thereby making that long edge 11 inches now.
Mm.
At least on the cut side. But I don't go all the way through because, of course, if you cut all the way through, a cut is no longer a cut, it's just an edge.
Yeah.
So it was important to not to have that operation but not complete the operation. And that was in and of itself interesting because it's possible, it's sort of less it's a little bit more messy to think of like an incomplete fold. But an incomplete cut that then becomes sort of another sort of grammatical statement within cutting of paper.
Mm-hmm. Were you freehanding these cuts, or were you?
Oh no, these were. I had sort of had a jig set up such that I could cut them in sort of in a perfect way. And also, I mean, for what it's worth, it should be mentioned, these are cut in the dark.
Okay.
So I couldn't see, and in complete dark, it's not even the red safe light because it's colored photographic paper.
Mm-hmm.
So it took a little while for me out, but once it systematized, it was pretty quick to do.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything in particular about paper other than it's a traditional photographic medium that draws you to it? Because I know that there's like paint on emulsion essentially that you can put on any surfaces, and being really interested in kind of the properties of the material like that, is there any thoughts you've had of using other materials, perhaps like cloth or?
Yeah, they definitely have, but I guess I've limited myself to paper in these last sort of couple of years because I guess I was thinking about sort of the inherent aspects of photography, and one of them that's not so inherent to photography as such, but more to like the culture of photography, is the sizes of paper, sort of which I alluded to before, the 4x5, 8x10, 11x14, and particularly that 4x5 size, which then exists in also 16x20 and 20x24, that sort of violates it.
Yeah.
But that size almost feels like the 4x5 ratio feels like almost like there exists a golden ratio, almost like the photographer's ratio.
Yeah, it really does kind of dominate just because that's how they make everything pre-made.
Right. And even today with inkjet stuff, though that's sort of being pushed aside with, now you see 8.5x11 paper rather than 8x10 paper for inkjet, which kind of ruins it. But it was important for me to use this, to having subtracted sort of the cultural aspect of the imagery, I sort of still wanted to keep its that which contained the imagery, this rectangle which contained the imagery.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, yeah, to go back to your question, I definitely don't rule things like that. That out. Just I haven't nor do I have sketches at the moment to abandon the paper.
Mm. And I was curious to know about the pieces that you had with the person in them, the portrait, because that's one of the only things that has anything that's not purely geometric in it.
Right. There's also the hands, which we can talk about maybe next.
Okay. I didn't see those pieces, but...
Right. So, the portraits, looking... When I was sort of getting the show ready, I was thinking about how it would look like when it was up, and I was curious to see what would happen after having put imagery at arm's length for a long time. What would happen if, having learned these new lessons from making work and within just sort of the the reduced variables of photography, what happened if I bring that imagery back, having, again, applying the lessons for that I learned.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess there's many other experiments that I did that I don't think resulted so in such sort of in as fruitful pieces. For instance, I would combine sometimes the exposure of paper with folding, and then so I would take a piece of paper, sort of crunch it up, or either fold it systematically, expose it some imagery on it, usually people, and then sort of fold it back out and see what happened. But often that invited sort of this reading of violence, which
mm-hmm.
was problematic.
Tearing people apart in a way.
Exactly, yeah. Which I wasn't interested in. But I was very much interested in having people because I was interested in the distortion of the imagery.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the human form is the most familiar form in the universe to any person because it's the form in which you sort of walk around and also the form in which you, you know,
mm-hmm.
love others, and et cetera. So it was important to have that form because I thought that was the easiest thing to put together when I did distortion. And so the imagery, the images here of the portrait, maybe I'll talk about how it's made. It's a so it's an im- it's a photograph of a girl, and that photograph is printed sort of in a normal way, such that it would sort of yield a healthy image. And this is all done in the darkroom. So I have a negative of this person of her head,
mm.
and I print it in a normal way. But then I take that. I guess I take the variables that are sort of are inside of this. So there's cyan light hitting it, yellow light, and magenta light, and that's what constructs the healthy image, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I took those and separated them both in sort of time. That is, like, I would expose it with cyan, then yellow, then magenta, and perhaps even more importantly, also in terms of sort of space. So I would expose the cyan for the cyan of the negative onto the paper at a 4x5 inch size, and the yellow at an 8x10, and the magenta at 11:14.
Okay.
And that's and that color separation. And then if you think of sort of the numbers there, that means that there's six possibilities
mm.
of, you know, from largest to smallest, CYM, CMY, YCM, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And that thereby yields sort of the six heads in the set.
So you're kind of seeing the composite of all the standard sizes and different color
right.
filtrations in each image. And is that are all those images the same portrait that we're seeing there too? Because
exactly.
they all look very different. Like.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting thing. I mean, they do look different, but they are the same, the very exact same
mm-hmm.
Negative. And with this piece, the distortion that's going on here is, of course, taking this healthy color image and sort of subtracting out the colors.
Mm-hmm.
In some sense, it's sort of a pure form that is. You see the component parts, but it's of course abstracted.
Mm-hmm. I can definitely see where there's a scientific chemistry thought process and that of reducing things to its parts and reassembling it, just like in chemistry.
right, yeah. And that's what, I mean, that's what science is about, like this
mm-hmm.
empiricism of taking what seemingly obvious or what seemingly whole and seeing presenting pieces to it.
There were some other pieces that we haven't spoken about specifically. There were kind of diamond patterns of color right there.
Oh, right. So these are kind of difficult because they don't really come across in photographs that well.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the examples of the folding.
I think I saw some more close-up ones where you could really see the folds in the paper.
Right, yeah. And that becomes something that's sort of really important with this work because the photographic representation of these photographs actually isn't that satisfying because there's a lot of, like, materiality going on within them that's important to see. But still, I mean, something... What's interesting then about that is that then you just see the visual part of this and not the material part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that means this investigation of components itself has components within it, right? The
mm-hmm.
visual, the tactile, etc.
Can you explain, like, exactly how you made those, though? Because I can understand, like, where you folded the paper and get the
sure.
color separations, but I don't understand necessarily how you got the different colors in the different quadrants and
oh, right.
things.
So in general, like, sort of the formula that's going on here with the paper, so they're 8x10-inch pieces of paper, and they're each folded at a 45-degree angle from each corner and folded away from the emulsion. So that makes four folds.
Mm-hmm.
And from each of those folds, there's because the paper is 8x10, there's and coming 45-degree from the corner, there's a smaller triangle and a larger sort of quadrilateral. And I took each resulting triangle and exposed it with one of the pure filters of the enlarger, so again, CYM. Or, in this case, since I had a fourth variable that I didn't know what to do with, I just gave it gray. Mm-hmm. So I figured out in the enlarger what would give me gray. And then I figured out that, okay, so there exists this folding pattern, this like light pattern that is like the folds have, each has a smaller triangle that I want to expose, and I have four of these types of light that I want to shine on it. And that gives, sort of doing the permutations, just gives 24 possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I only did 12 because half of those result from rotating the object, which I thought was something that sort of the imagination could do.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, you know, you the order in which you expose that, either cyan to this edge and then to the opposite edge, yellow, then magenta and gray can switch spots, and those are become sort of mirror images of
mm-hmm.
each other's, and enantiomers, actually, to use like a chemical term. And right, so that's what gives the 12 possibilities. And it, for a reason that maybe I can't entirely still forgot, it also gives like somewhat different colors, even though the operations are the same.
There's some kind of gradation piece that you have here. It looks large. Is it large?
Yeah, it's large. So it's 153 inches tall,
okay,
by 44 inches wide. And with this piece, and this is actually a digital or an inkjet photograph.
Okay.
Or at least like a photographically made print.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening here is I took the sample of the color of the floor, and this is a wooden floor in the Backlog Gallery at Mass Art.
Mm-hmm.
And so sort of got the average color of the floor at this particular spot. I mean, it was generally all the same out, but particularly the spot. And took that color and went into Photoshop and made it graded from that color to white. So from the color of the floor to the color, or to white, which was
mm-hmm.
the gallery walls. And then installed that piece going from the floor to the ceiling and made the piece exactly the height of the gallery.
Mm-hmm.
So in some sense, the content of the piece came from the gallery, and that it went from the color of the floor to the white, but also the size of the piece came from the gallery. So
mm-hmm.
matching exactly the height of the gallery. So I sort of intended it to be kind of like, again, thinking about like the anthropomorphizing of the print. So in this sense, the paper almost wants to be at its feet the color of the floor, and at its head the color of the gallery wall.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting how the whole space dictates what the piece is.
Right, yeah. And I was interested sort of, you know, to go to some of the categorizations of art. Like I was thinking with this piece, I was thinking in its inception, I was thinking about like how can you have like a truly like site specific photograph, and
mm-hmm.
kinetic, not only site responsive or like sort of getting funny in with installation, but actually like a site specific photograph.
Was it difficult to try to settle on the floor color? Because I know there's a lot of different things that go into how we see color, especially on a waxed wooden floor, so there's like reflections and
different things. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. It started out as a photograph I made with just a regular digital camera.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took that and averaged it in Photoshop and printed it out and took it to the gallery to see if it matched, and it didn't. And that was probably the result of, you know, like wrong profiles or wrong color, like light settings.
Mm-hmm.
And from that point on, I had the sample and I just sort of had to sort of adjust it as if I were sort of matching this color sample. So I remember it needed to be sort of lighter and also more red and more yellow. So I just kept doing that, going from the printer to the gallery until I had something pretty close.
Mm.
And
how many different tries did that take? About 10 or so?
I think actually like 13,
mm-hmm.
exactly, because I remember numbering all the pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But it is an interesting point you bring up about like the waxiness of the floor. Because especially in installing the piece, I discovered that I could never really, it would actually be impossible to match to, in a seamless way, go from the floor to the wall, only because both of these surfaces, which are reflective, the print and the floor, reflect each other. So
mm-hmm.
in an installed form, the print was actually looked more saturated than it should be. And that was because it was reflecting the saturation, the orangeness of these wooden floors.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look to sort of to the right of the print, and you can even see it in this reproduction, it's actually, the floor is actually reflecting the white of the gallery wall. So it's not only the floor coming through, but the reflection upon it. So in some sense, it would be unless it, these are totally matte or non-reflective surfaces, this would be sort of impossible to match one to the other. But that was interesting because it's a lesson I learned that when I look at the edge of a gallery from really far away, I'm not only seeing the color of the floor, I'm also seeing the wall and the floor.
And are there any other pieces here in your recent works that we haven't talked about yet?
So these are, I made photograms of my hands, and there was sort of more going on because they're actually color, despite looking like they're
black and white.
Like
small black and white.
Right. So
photographs.
There actually is a little bit of a gradation of color from through the white of the hand, where the paper didn't get exposed, to the black of the paper where it got exposed. So there's actually like a sort of like a, almost like a color wheel. Colors in there, like, and I'm using some of the other colors that exist in my work, like the cyan, yellow, magenta, and RGB of the larger. But probably even more important than that, I mean, as you said before, there's not a lot of imagery in my work, and this was, I guess, this was a piece that I thought was interesting because it's hung, I guess, in a peculiar way, in that it's basically like 100 inches high. From the ground, you know, very far off from the 60 inches on center from which we're supposed to hang photographs. And also to this duality of having the two hands that place in such a way that sort of imply the body but don't quite satisfy that. So in their installed state, I think they're 100 inches high and about 90 inches apart, which is impossible for any living human being to...
That's what I was wondering. 100 inches sounds a little high for casually reaching up or...
Right. And at that point, even the average height person even jumping that high would be a little bit tough. So I guess I wanted to think about how what happened when you installed these two photographs that were, again, like sort of mirror images of each other. When I installed them in sort of a funny way that wasn't its regular format. And also what happened when I put it so high, such that again, like it implies the body, almost like a literary device, synecdoche, where the hand implies the hand makes you think of the body.
Is there any reason why you settled on the hand as the image to represent the whole body?
Yeah, I guess maybe that's kind of like a serendipitous thing, and these are my hands in particular. They sort of fit perfectly within an 8x10 inch. Piece of paper, and I sort of I try to stay, at least with this work, I try to stay faithful to that dimension and that size in particular. But that's a good point. I mean, it could easily just have been foot or head.
You could do some feet on the floor, on the ceiling, I guess, if you wanted to make it.
Yeah,
unrealistic.
And that brings a good point. If I ever put this work up in the future, I would probably maybe even put the hands either touching the ceiling or the hands on the floor. That way, you know, to move this body that exists but doesn't exist inside of it around.
And that piece that we were looking at below there, is that also hand-based or no? That's
no. So this is sort of more like a modular piece. And what's happening here is that these are all, I guess, like the operation happening here is I took a camera and exposed the sky from using a digital camera, where I would get no information in the sensor, it's all the way to blacking it out. So, for instance, with the nighttime sky, the midnight sky, which is the one all the way on the right, I took a camera and photographed the midnight sky at, you know, say something like 1/100th of a second, which would give you no information in the sensor. But then systematically raising the exposure, 1/3 of a stop, all the way to maybe like a minute gives me some information in the sensor, and then like 4 minutes gives me even more. All the way up until I blew out the sensor with the amount of light that was coming, despite it being the nighttime sky, because there's still sort of photons like traveling around and coming into the camera.
How long does it take that to happen at night?
Well, I think the last one is 12 minutes.
Okay.
But the daytime ones were sort of, I guess, like less cumbersome in that regard with regard to time.
Because
the other ones were done with a blue sky that's during the day, and the other one an overcast sky.
Okay.
But again, following the same operation, but without, you know, with such a bright sky, to black out the sensor, to get no information in the sensor, would take maybe like 1/2000th or 1/4000th of a second.
And so that one on the right is at night. That red and orange that we're eventually seeing is essentially like the starlight that's coming through the camera.
Right, perhaps. I should mention that it was then in the city, so I think there's probably maybe like some light pollution going up and back down into the clouds. But it would be interesting just to do it. And that's whenever I I don't make it out of the city much, but whenever I do get out of the city with a place where there is no light pollution from some nearby towns, it would be interesting to see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
But another thing that's kind of wild about that is that Sorvino's, oftentimes, I think, particularly in the city where you look at the sky at night, it looks sort of pink, has like a pinkish hue.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of what I thought I would get when I did this piece, sort of it would go from black to pink to white. But for whatever reason, and this might have to do with the electronics of the camera, it gave me this orange instead of this pink. But it was also, you know, kind of a satisfying color, especially toward the end. It's not so visible here, but it becomes like a really pale, almost like sickly.
Yeah, it looks like
orange.
Almost a flesh tone, I would say.
Right. Yeah.
And that kind of stage-based work, and also pointing at the sky, reminds me of there was one you had where there's like a photo of the moon that's like slowly coming into focus. Is that related to this one at all?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, like it's maybe not in its making, but in like the sort of the structural way it happens. That is like the mechanics, not of if this piece and what the sky piece is the mechanics of the camera.
Mm-hmm.
That piece is probably like the mechanics of a piece of paper. So with that piece, what I did was I took my camera phone, and I have an iPhone, so it has like this big screen,
mm-hmm.
an exposed piece of paper from having a contact print of my phone, essentially, so it would be on the paper, and then sort of systematically raising it. And
okay.
The reason you see a moon is because on my home screen I have a moon.
Okay.
and that was kind of interesting by itself. It became a little bit, I guess, maybe serendipitous, you can say, because it's a moon. You can definitely see it's a moon, and it's most like formed state. And when I raise it systematically, I think from 0.3 inches, 0.6 inches, doubling distance, so 0.12 inches, etc. Until, again, I had no information coming, that is the light that was coming out of the phone, no longer exposed to paper.
Mm-hmm.
In that in-between state, there was something else. So in the same way that something happened with the nighttime images, something happened there in that the part of that the moon became sort of this fuzzy little circle, and also the part that on the iPhone, everyone knows there's that little thing that you push aside to turn on
unlock slide
right.
bar.
That became its own little circle, but a sort of a dimmer, smaller one,
mm-hmm.
against the moon, which was larger but still kind of dim and kind of hazy. And that sort of started to feel like a constellation. Now, but instead of the moon being the moon had its own moon, which was this
mm-hmm.
button.
And there was another piece that you did that was similar to that. What was that a picture of? It was out in a field with a sign.
Oh, right.
Was there a meaning to that, or was that kind of one of these kind of, I guess, disposable images that you're kind of referring to, like cell phone
right.
photos?
Right. Well, I guess I would consider it sort of disposable, in that the imagery that I used there wasn't so much so important.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted sort of a landscape image, so I went into my archives and found a landscape photograph
mm-hmm.
that I had. And the test there was almost actually very similar to the cell phone piece, where I systematically raised the object that was exposing the paper. But in this instance, I took a negative and systematically raised it, first making a contact sheet and then raising it
mm-hmm.
by a certain height, X, and then doubling X, and then doubling that until I enlarged the image to the size of the paper. But it not being focused and the negative being loose sort of made a lot of changes, sort of changed the size, of course, also changed the sharpness because it was no longer focused, and also changed the color in sort of a way that was unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that interests me in image making, sort of taking, or rather art making in general, taking a process, sort of having it's like a set equation, and even knowing all the variables that go into the equation, but the output sort of being still a surprise.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier getting a kind of corrupted file and using that to create a piece. I read the description and I thought that was an interesting idea, that this image that you have that's cut off is just like kind of a partial cell phone image, and making a piece of fine art out of it. Do you want to explain like what the whole process was of making that
right.
a piece? Because there was some kind of color separation down below it too, and I wasn't quite sure what part was digital or what part was physical. So.
Right. And that sort of highlights my lack of discrimination between, you know, either digital or darkroom processes, because the print that you're talking about is, I think, something like a 40 by 50 inch enlargement of a cell phone image that somebody sent me that was corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular image, there's sort of gray, I think, on the left, if I'm not mistaken, and it's sort of normal on the right. But
mm-hmm.
what was interesting is you could see that sort of I don't know if it's JPEG or not, that is a compression that happens on it, but you could see the tiling that happened and where it went from imagery, or that is image block, to gray. So
mm-hmm.
within the image, there was a column that went from, it wasn't sort of gray on the left, and it was gray on the left and imagery on the right, but there was, you could see like the, sort of the component part of it. And that was, to me, sort of like a very fruitful event, seeing is how this image was corrupted, and also seeing sort of the mechanics of how then cell phone images work, because the electronic stuff, the sort of, you know, more like nerdy stuff, is not something that I'm into,
mm-hmm.
except when something like distortion happens. And that also got me interested in sort of how we learn from mistakes, particularly thinking of how, particularly in the past, neuroscientists used to learn about how the brain worked from accident, from people who had accidents or strokes, for instance,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, about like Broca's area, how that affects speech, how this particular part of the brain affects how you can speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was interested in how distortion of imagery could teach me how imagery was made. And so that explains sort of the top image. And also I sort of felt it was kind of like again, going back to what I said before, by itself was kind of a seductive image. There's image of half sky, half ocean. But that this sort of like nice idyllic image gets cut by like this grayness of
mm-hmm.
this artifact from distortion sending. And the little rectangles that are on the bottom are, for me, thinking about like sort of the grayness of the imagery. That is, it seemed like gray was what sort of like the base imagery was, because that's what the part that I guess didn't come through or was distorted, so it sort of defaults to gray.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about what composes gray, right? And so those little ones are sort of all the possibilities using the enlarger, sort of all the sort of filter possibilities. So using all the filters, CYM, using two of them, CY, CM, YC, or rather YM,
mm.
And also just C and Y and M, and seeing what colors those give me. And also, I think one of them is just a piece of paper that doesn't have any lead in it. So I wanted to see what the components of having learned what the components, or how at least maybe the part of the structure of MMS messaging. I'm going to see what the components or structure is of just regular darkroom prints.
Mm. And when you had this photo on your phone, were you able to see that transition stripe where it broke?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And even between that, I mean, I don't know how much, there's like a little bit, in Photoshop, like the base non-transparent background, there's like this tiling from, I think it's blue to white, like blue, white, that goes around
mm-hmm.
it. And you could see some of that, like, inside of the, like, in the background, almost as if, like, there's, even beyond the gray, there's more, like...
It's like seeing quarks or something.
Right. yeah. Behind, like, the atom, there's, like, something
mm-hmm.
that's actually not invisible. There's more there, yeah.
Well, I think we've covered all your recent work pretty well, but I was interested to know about some of your early work, too.
Sure.
The Ciudad de los Reyes...
Right.
And Construction were the two
mm-hmm.
Series that I saw, and they're more traditional, like you said, more straight photography, but I thought they were very interesting imagery, and I bet there's some good stories about going to these sites and finding the shots, so do you want to tell us a little bit about what was happening in those?
Sure, yeah. Well, the work that I did in Lima, Ciudad de los Reyes, which is Spanish for City of Kings,
mm-hmm.
And that's the sort of this epithet that exists for the city of Lima.
Okay.
I think even at its founding by Pizarro in the 16th or 15th century, it was named City of the Kings.
Mm-hmm.
And now it sort of exists as sort of a moniker that like, tourist companies use to
mm-hmm.
lure people into the city.
Just like which city, Salem.
right, yeah. And I guess what that work, what I was most interested in was Lima is kind of like a very interesting place, like atmospherically, or... There's like an interesting phenomenon going on there visually, where it's a tropical city that states in the tropics, like actually pretty close to the equator. The equator runs through part, I think actually a piece of Lima or a piece of Peru.
Mm-hmm.
So Lima is a tropical city, but at the same time, the city's a desert, and literally a desert, getting, I think, 0.3 inches of rainfall a year. And despite that, it's the city is almost always overcast, especially in the winter. So it's gray in the sky, and down below it's sort of this pale brown of just raw earth. And that created sort of interesting visual moments that I wanted to capture for that work.
Yeah, definitely. It looks like the Sahara in some shots.
Right. And people are surprised. I mean, people often, or if not the sort of, you know, that part of Africa, they often compare it to the Middle East, which also has sort of similar, you know, hazy atmospherics that are barren.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, of course, interested in that, but also what happened when. So you have this sort of atmospheric moment, and in between there's this sprawling city of 8 million people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important for me in a lot of the work, and much of the work at least, to get to sort of highlight all those things. And that entailed going to often the outskirts of the city where you could still see the earth, because it was important for me to get that, I guess, like to have that almost as a base point, and sort of in relation to the sky as well.
How did you end up specifically in Peru?
Well, my family, I was actually born in Lima myself, and my family is from there, and actually much of my family still lives there.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it was kind of luck. I was interested in, at the time, like most of the visuals I tended toward were sort of muted or pastel-y colors, and I had this sort of hometown that was sort of, you know, bleeding this stuff. So it felt like sort of kind of like serendipitous being able to go there. But I mean, if I had enough money, like I would go to the parts of the Sahara or the Middle East that people keep talking to me about and photograph there. But this is, you know, kind of special because I had access to it and I was interested in it, which you should always pay attention to.
Yeah. Do you go there very often, or was that kind of a once and every so often?
Right. Well, when I was making that work, I used to go pretty often. I mean, once a year or more. But I haven't been back to Peru maybe in like two or so years at this point. And so that sort of shows you that largely my tie to going there was often to with like making work. I mean, I would like to go back, not to make work necessarily, but also visit family, but sort of things have kept me occupied for the last few years.
And were you making those photographs for the series Construction around the same time as that series that we saw?
It was, those kind of had a little bit of overlap.
Okay.
The series Construction was just sort of almost what it sounds like, me going around construction sites and photographing. And again, I was sort of lucky because at the time I was traveling quite a bit. I was in college, so
were a lot of those construction sites in Peru then?
Some of them were, and some of them were sort of nearby my college in New Jersey. Some nearby my parents' home in South Carolina. And at the time, I also studied in Italy, so somewhere there, and again going to the home, which is, I guess, Peru, somewhere there. And that was interesting, of course, in a comparative, but I was still interested in sort of this site of construction, sort of this transitory phase of buildings where also, you know, where outside becomes inside. But that's what, when I was going through this project and I went to Peru to do it, I sort of did, I of course still made images for this series Construction, but also realized that there was something else I had to pay attention to, thus leading to that next project, the Lima work.
Is there a lot of new construction going on in Peru? Or I'm a little curious to know like what the life is like there at the time, because there are some shots that it almost looked like a modern day kind of like Old West town where there's a small row of buildings along a deserted road. And then you could also see in other photos that it looks like New York if it was kind of wrapped around some mountain foothills or something. So
Oh, right.
I was trying to get a sense of the dynamic of the city today.
Right. And I think the images you're referring to are mostly from the series in Lima, the Ciudad de los Reyes. And those, yeah, I mean, it's kind of an interesting place to travel around, especially in the outskirts, because basically, like, the typical Limeian or the typical piece of Lima isn't at all the piece or the person that the typical tourist sees when they travel in the city. I mean, Lima does have these sort of traditionally beautiful parts of it that look like Buenos Aires, that look like Paris, that look like London, you know, the nice, beautiful, you know, metropolitan streets and the ornate, you know, European, like, classical-style buildings. But the Lima today is more defined by its sort of outside rim. I don't have the exact numbers, but easily the majority of Lemayans live in these places that are only recently developed, and developed mostly in a haphazard way.
Mm-hmm.
That is, mostly by, in many, many cases, by squatting. So Lima is sort of very, very flat and keeps growing sort of almost by the day.
Mm-hmm.
Less so than its heyday, I think, in like the 70s and the 80s. So that's what sort of contributes to a lot of the sort of sometimes a haphazard, like funny building where you see, you know, a road and like houses like popping up along it, or you see what once was sort of the sprawling desert and then sort of a town sort of almost just growing from
mm-hmm.
from it, because people can go, and even to this day still not so much again as before, but people can go to the edge of the city, to the edge of the neighborhood of the city and make a house there. And eventually that's not just you, but someone else does the same thing and becomes a neighborhood, becomes its own little district.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's sort of ebbed today, but still.
Have you gotten a chance to travel around much else of the area in South America and see regions around there?
Only Peru, actually. And
mm-hmm.
I was just thinking about this recently. I got to travel a couple years ago. I had a car and I traveled around most of southern Peru, and that's because I got to know the city of Lima so well that I wanted to become familiar with other parts of Peru.
Mm-hmm.
And that was interesting because Peru is a very like diverse city in terms of like in terms of landscape or geography. There's the coast, sort of the dry deserty coast, the Andes Mountains, and then the rainforest, the Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky enough to be able to travel in all of those. And I was actually just recently with a teacher sending a message about how going from one city, this city called Huancayo, and taking the sort of like off the beaten path, this direct but sort of not so traveled path to Satipo, which is in the rainforest, was kind of wild because you saw that gradation going from sort of this semi like deserty Andean part
mm.
of Peru to the outright rainforest.
Mm. So how long will it be before we see a photographic gradation of
oh,
that
yeah.
transition?
Yeah, I mean, and maybe that gets to like that sort of speaks to my interest in, you know, like the piecemeal parts of going from one extreme, you know, complete dryness to like the extreme of complete lushness, which maybe not taking that substance, but taking that structure one extreme to the other, but showing the pieces in between sort of speaks a lot of the work
mm-hmm.
that I have.
I guess kind of along that line, now that you're graduated, what kind of work do you hope to pursue in the near future?
Well, I still have like a lot of sketches, like even from like my school from like the last few months that I want to sort of work out, and that relate not only to the work I was making, but now that I saw, you know, in a nice thesis exhibition, like I was able to sit with that for a while to see what happens from that. So I've sort of got to work through those a little, but yeah, I mean, it's hard to talk about future work because it's like not there yet, but
yeah.
I think something that I'll try a little bit more in the past is instead of taking photographs and making them sculptural, sort of working with sculpture in its sort of whole form and photography, which there are a few interesting artists doing that today, and
mm-hmm.
I think it's like a place that's ripe for
what kind of artists are doing that today that you're interested in?
Someone like Letha Wilson, who and yeah, probably her in particular. Either taking, again, marrying sculpture and photography in an interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
And other people, something like Wolfgang Tillmans, has done something actually similar to what I do. I'm sure he did it first, but taking paper and folding it and showing it in sort of folded aspect,
mm-hmm.
but coming off the wall like a lot more, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. It's a pleasure talking to you. Really interesting ideas behind your work and very interesting work in itself.
Okay, thanks.
And thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right.
And that concludes this episode of Studio Sessions with our guest Carlos Jimenez Cahua. You can find his work online at carlosjimenezcahua.com. You can also learn more about me at my website, mattkuhlman.com. If you would like to support this program, you can send a donation through PayPal to studiosessionspodcast@gmail.com. Even if you only send $1, your donation helps guarantee that I can continue providing interviews with interesting artists for your listening pleasure. And of course, don't forget to visit BigRedAndShiny.com for future episodes along with other arts and culture content. Thank you for listening, and see you next time on Studio Sessions.